Hello there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and a little bit of what have you. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, we're going to try to do the healthcare bill in the first segment, just a little trying to rationalize it, to make it a little clearer what's going to happen, when it's going to happen. And then I would be very interested in any comments or discussion, any contributions, and of course, also, as always, your questions on general healthcare topics. But let's get started. Okay, so we have a earth-shaking sort of first step in healthcare reform. As I said last week, it looks like we've got our foot through the door, a little big toe through the door. Let's talk about what we do have. Starting in September, children can stay on their parents' health plans until they're 26, given that most people's startup jobs after high school or college do not have good healthcare benefits. This is a really wonderful thing in this economy. That will be in place by September. Also in place by September, no lifetime maximum, so you can't be told, I'm sorry, but you've used up your $6 million lifetime maximum and we will no longer pay anything for your cancer therapy. Something that actually happens to people in this country. Other things that will go on in September, no pre-existing conditions for children, and a federal high-risk pool for people who have pre-existing conditions or cancer or other problems, such that they will be able to, in fact, find health insurance. Phasing in slowly over a few more years through 2014, we have the adult pre-existing requirements. So adults cannot be excluded for pre-existing conditions. We also have the formation of these statewide healthcare exchanges, which allow for some collective bargaining on the part of those previously really disadvantaged individuals who are self-employed or people who are in very small companies. So that's a good thing. And we're happy to see that coming in 2014. It's a long way away. At that point in 2014, the calculations are that 95% of eligible Americans, U.S. adults, in other words, who actually are here legally, will have healthcare coverage. And the donut hole in 2014 will also have been substantially closed. Actually, the donut hole happens a bit sooner. Medicare's donut hole, for those of you who are regular listeners to the program, you know that that means that after people reach about $2,800 in their Medicare drug cost, they fall into a hole. Their costs are no longer covered until you get to $3,600. So in 2010, you will get a $250 rebate if you fall into the donut hole. And in 2011, the brand name drugs will be discounted by 50% while you're in the donut hole. By 2020, the discount will be 25%, and supposedly by 2020, the donut hole goes away. I'm seeing some contradictions there in the write-ups, and so I'm not really quite sure about whether the donut hole phases out entirely or whether it's left in at a level. Now, let's do the finances on this in just a little bit of round numbers. This is going to be funded by a number of, I guess you call them progressive taxes, which is to say that it's a tax on the richer people. Something new, a 3.8% tax on investment income. And one source I encountered, that by the way kicks in 2014, one source that I encountered said that if you make $1 million a year, it will cost you about $46,000 in extra cash. That's the equivalent, if you're making $1 million a year, of hiring another full-time employee about. And it's also twice the poverty level for a family of four. So this tax does reverse a long-term trend in this country of reducing taxes on the very wealthiest Americans and increasing them, relatively speaking, on the less wealthy. I don't know whether this trend will continue, but it is a real policy reversal and probably one of the more interesting historical things. There's also the tax on the high-cost plans, which has been criticized by unions and also is a concern for many people who are really looking at the numbers, because if premiums continue to increase unchecked, then this tax could kick in for most of us by 2020. We really do need to recognize that this bill does not generate the kind of fundamental changes in upward price pressures that we really need to see for healthcare reform in this country. Other things that are expanded, if you are on Medicaid, Medicaid is expanded quite a bit. That means that 130% of federal poverty level, that's $29,000 for a family of four, you'd be able to qualify for Medicaid. It subsidizes healthcare for people who are required to buy insurance now, and up to 400% of federal poverty level, that's $88,000 for a family of four, will get a subsidy to help them pay for their healthcare costs. The premiums for a family of four at twice poverty level, that $44,000 level, is capped at 6% of income. So that means if you're making $44,000 a year and you have two kids, your healthcare costs for all of you are $200 a month. That's a much, much bigger improvement than it used to be. Employers who have more than 50 employees are not required to pay for health care. That was a real change. We were looking at an employer mandate in earlier versions of this. But instead, of their 50 employees, if only one of them qualifies for a subsidized health care plan, in other words, because of the mandate to individuals, if only one of your employees qualifies for federal subsidies, then a magic tax kicks in and the employers have to pay $2,000 per employee per year. So you do the math, that's a lot of money per employee per year to cover all that health care if only one of your employees ends up triggering a federal subsidy. So it's not a mandate, but it's a heck of a penalty for not providing health care. Big gamble for the employer. And if you've got 50 employees, they all better be making a lot of money in order for you to avoid paying for their health care. A really interesting, strange way of effectively creating an employer mandate. Now, there's some the usual sausage making going on in this bill. I'm just going to touch on the fact that the absurd way that abortions are handled, in that two checks will have to be written by anyone who opts for a plan that covers abortion, and the health plans themselves will have to maintain two separate funds to be sure that not a drop of federal money of these subsidies actually goes to fund abortion. And there's also a increased payment to primary care doctors, getting Medicaid rates, or Medi-Cal in this state, up to the same rate as Medicare. That's a really good thing. That'll increase access for people on Medicaid. And there's a 10% tax, a sales tax on indoor tanning, which I thought the indoor tanning people really missed getting their lobbyist into the right offices for that thing to still make it through the bill. Not that it's a bad thing. Indoor tanning definitely costs money. In the long run, it causes skin cancer and therefore is a problem. But overall, I think it's a step in the right direction. It eliminates some of the major injustices of the system, although not all of them. And it certainly creates a lot of room for game playing and maneuvering. But hey, that seems to be the way the world works. I wanted to thank Duff in Felton for all of his science news this week. He had a couple of very interesting stories. One of these, I think one that you'll all be interested in, is hand sanitizer versus soap. And we've all seen in the proliferation of the little things of hand sanitizer. You can't walk into a hospital without finding them scattered throughout the corridors. There's one in every hospital room at our local Dominican hospital. I have one in the car. I have one in my purse. So I was very interested to see this study, which was published in the March issue of Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy. Researchers at the Virginia School of Medicine and the Dial Corporations collaborated on this study looking at soap and water versus ethanol hand sanitizers for removing rhinovirus. What the researchers did was interesting. They put virus on people's hands and then they gave them one of six different hand treatments and then saw if they could detect virus on their hands afterwards. Well, soap and water removed about 31% of the rhinovirus on hands, or more accurately, 31% of the hands had no detectable rhinovirus. On the other hand, the ethanol hand sanitizer removed it from 80% of the hands, a much higher level. So quite significant and important, I think. The hand sanitizers win. Pardon me, I'm going to say it, hands down. Let's go to Michael in Santa Cruz. Hello, Michael, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, so around 10 months ago, I thrashed the roof of my mouth with some chips that I was eating.
Uh-huh.
And the roof of my mouth has not healed since then.
What's it look like?
Well, it's what it feels like is, can you imagine, you know, like perhaps burning your mouth with pizza or, you know, that kind of rough feeling.
Sure.
Okay, and it goes from the right directly behind my teeth to around a quarter of an inch back where the ridge is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I've been to my PCP, I've been to an ear, nose, and throat specialist, I've been to my dentist, I've been to my oral surgeon. They ruled out cancer. So,
does it look funny, or is it just feel funny?
They say it looks funny as well. When they're looking at it, there's a pupae, I think, or something like that's a little bit swollen. So I think there's a little bit of a swollen look to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they record. Okay. I mean, this is what they've told me.
And we're talking about your palate, not your tongue.
Yes, my palate.
Okay.
It's, yeah, the roof of my mouth.
The roof of your mouth.
So I figured I'd tell you a few things about myself. I'm 57. I've been a vegetarian for most of my adult life. The last 5 years, I've eaten a little bit of fish here and there. And I've tried to treat it. I'm a health-oriented kind of person, alternative health, and I've tried to treat it several different ways. I changed the way I eat food, so I'm eating food on the side of my mouth, so I'm trying to avoid scraping it to re-injure it.
Yes.
I've taken, the last few weeks, I've taken a fair amount of vitamin C, A, D, and E. I tried salt water, rinsing. I tried aloe vera rinsing. I've tried golden seal and echinacea rinsing. And then recently, I had an opportunity to talk to another doctor, and she said, well, maybe there's a fungus going on that's preventing the healing. So I talked to my PCP, and I took a Diflucan one day this past week, and I've been swishing my mouth with Nystatin for the past 5 days. And those are the treatments that I've tried the last 10 months, but it's not healing.
Okay, so normally the mouth is very rapidly regenerative.
Yeah.
So this suggests to me that something is keeping this going. I'm thinking about, okay, obviously the PCP and the ENT are scratching their heads. Mm-hmm. Then it's not part of the conventional medicine universe, because I'm going to assume that these are competent professional individuals who know their conventional medicine universe. And you told me that you tore it up eating corn chips, which is...
They were actually pita chips.
Pita chips.
Yeah, they were really sort of hard.
Right.
And I was unconsciously eating, so I was doing it for a couple of days in a row, maybe 3 or 4 days.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized, this is a long time ago, oh my God, my roof of my mouth is not healing.
And were you unconsciously eating because you were stressed out?
I was at work, and I was just, during lunch, checking out the internet. So it wasn't like...
Okay, maybe. We'll give that a maybe.
Okay.
All right. I think you should get gluten testing for gluten antibodies. First of all, pita chips is even more suspicious because of wheat. But mouth sores, mouth aphthous ulcers, stomatitis of any kind that isn't healing, now that I've kind of got one foot solidly planted in alternative land, I think about a gluten reaction. It's just when you go looking for this, you find it rather frequently. So you could do the testing. You could just stop eating any gluten, and I have another suggestion for ways to promote healing, but stop eating gluten totally for 2 or 3 weeks and see if you have been perpetuating the injury because you've actually got antibody in your mouth against gluten that's being triggered. It's in your saliva. It's IgA, secretory antibody, and it could be triggering and perpetuating this inflammatory condition. It's a hypothesis. It's easily disprovable hypothesis. It's a bit inconvenient, but if you're used to a natural food lifestyle, which sounds like as a vegetarian you probably are, it will not be that difficult for you to eliminate gluten
Exactly.
Because you're used to eliminating things.
Right, I could definitely do that.
And so the testing that I would recommend if you decide to go forward with testing would be IgA for deaminated gliadin and also for tissue transglutaminase. And if both of those are negative, then I'm wrong about this being the perpetuator of your problem. But a food sensitivity definitely is on my mind as you describe this issue. And you could have had it at a low level and then amplified it up with the CHIP experience, particularly since you were doing direct physical trauma. But actually, it may not have been the physical trauma of the CHIP. It may have been the immune reaction that just amped up on you, and you misinterpreted it as being due to the texture of the CHIP. It's unusual for people to injure themselves with food. I mean, not in a directly cutting your mouth kind of way.
Right, right.
We injure ourselves with food all the time, so I wanted to clarify that.
Right. What's interesting is that if I bit my gum or something like that, or my cheek, it's healed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's an interesting thing as well. So I often think, oh my God, is there something wrong with my immune system? Because I am healing in other parts of my mouth, mm-hmm. that one area is not.
Yeah, well, let's try that and see.
Okay.
And I wanted to mention something short term.
Sure.
There are things called humectants. Licorice root is one.
Okay.
So just like it tends to coat the surface.
Right.
Actually kind of putting a little bit of licorice root, either using the tea or sucking on a little bit of licorice root. Mm-hmm. There's a pharmaceutical called Carafate, which comes in a liquid. You could apply that liquid to the part of your mouth that is injured, and it sticks to injured mucosa.
Oh, good. So I was wondering, so that's called Carafate?
Carafate is the trade name, and I am currently blanking on what the, generic name is, but I do think that you could get a prescription of that from your PCP,
either
for the liquid or the lozenges you could suck on.
Oh, that would be good.
But it'll coat the surface and make you a little bit more comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and then nothing wrong with that.
Great.
Someone actually called in just now off the air, and it's a good thought, so I wanted to throw it out there.
Right.
But B12 deficiency can sometimes lead to this, and that could be tested by a blood test.
Okay, great.
And it's common with vegetarians, so it's worth thinking about.
Great.
All right, well,
thank
I hope that helps, and thanks to the caller who called in with that good idea.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that.
Let's go to Patrick in Santa Cruz. Hello, Patrick, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking the call. My topic today, this morning, is my gout.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm soon to turn 60 years old, and right now I'm suffering frequent flare-ups. And I'm now looking at my medication, recently prescribed. I'm looking at allopurinol,
mm-hmm.
colchicine,
mm-hmm.
and most recently, indomethacin.
Uh-huh.
To me. I'd like your input on proper administration of these medicines to control a flare-up and or regularly control and help prevent these flare-ups.
Okay. So let's start with defining gout. It's a defect in the way your body breaks down certain kinds of protein byproducts called purines. And these purines would normally be broken down into uric acid, which would then be eliminated by the urinary tract, by the kidneys. And in some people, the problem is that they produce more purine and thus more uric acid than normal. These people are called the overproducers. And then there are people whose kidneys are not as efficient at eliminating the uric acid, and these people are called the under-excretors. How you target gout is with either reducing the production of uric acid, that's your allopurinol, or improving the excretion of the uric acid, and that would be your indomethacin. That helps improve the excretion, and it also is an anti-inflammatory. There are other drugs, probenecid, which has been around for a long time, Benamid is the trade name, helps get rid of uric acid through the urinary tract. So that's a way of eliminating the backup of the uric acid into the blood, which then leads to it crystallizing in the joint fluids, which is what causes the gout and the inflammation. Now, your colchicine acts by preventing the inflammatory cells, the so-called macrophages, from moving. So it kind of slows them down so they don't release as much acid and inflammatory materials. So it's a kind of odd anti-inflammatory drug, but it's going to be most active when you are having a gout attack. So it's a sort of reversing agent. Think of it like a fire extinguisher. So the allopurinol is your preventer, your fire resistance, maybe something that makes your system less likely to flare up in the first place, if you will. And then the others are fire extinguishers of various sorts. Have you been following a low-purine diet? Did your doctor give you a diet?
Suggestions were made, and I am trying to, and still experiencing some flare-ups. I have eliminated things like red meat, pork, shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'm eating a lot of chicken and fillet fish,
mm-hmm.
and still experiencing some discomfort, possibly less.
And you're on all three of these agents at once.
Well, I want to ask you how to properly administer them. On a daily basis, without a flare-up, would I just be up in the morning and take allopurinol?
Yeah, normally what we do is we start the allopurinol between flare-ups. You don't want to put someone on allopurinol in an acute flare. So if someone comes in and they've obviously got gout, I like to get a uric acid in the serum just to see if it's high, because it tends to be high in the overproducers, and so they're going to respond more readily to allopurinol. If their uric acid is normal, I don't know for sure that they're an under-excreter, but I'm more likely to suspect it, so I'm more likely to use Benamid and Probenecid and maybe constant low-dose indomethacin, or that I used to do that. I don't do that anymore because I'm concerned about the integrity of the intestines more than I used to be. Anyway, so you're coming in, you're in, not in a big flare. Allopurinol is the preventative agent. And then the indomethacin, yes or no, depending upon whether you get complete resolution of the ongoing symptoms. If you don't, then the indomethacin. And then during acute flares, that's when the colchicine is really helpful.
All right, that's the fire extinguisher. On a daily basis, I wouldn't get up in the morning in between flares and take any colchicine.
I try not to use drugs unnecessarily. So, yes, sure. That's correct.
And the indomethacin, again, another fire extinguisher?
It's a little bit of both, because it does increase the excretion. I should say I don't anymore because of other considerations, but I used to have people take a low dose of indomethacin as a preventative, so 12.5 to 25 milligrams, just to keep them peeing out. But now I use probenecid for that instead, because of my concern around not letting the person damage their mucosa in their intestine and then start getting food sensitivities. And like I said, with all of the gluten sensitivity that I'm sort of uncovering now that I'm aware that it exists.
The name of that treatment again?
Probenecid. P-R-O-B-E-N-E-C-I-D or something close to that. I hate spelling things on the air because I was not the spelling bee queen. Go ahead.
That's another name for Benamid?
Yeah, and Benamid's the old-fashioned trade name, but I'm sure it's generic.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate your help. I think I've got a better... up in the morning and an allopurinol and an indomethacin?
Until you're symptom-free, yeah.
Until I'm symptom-free. Then I would just take allopurinol, perhaps?
That's pretty much how I do it. I'm surprised that you didn't get more specific instructions from your doctor.
Well, with all three of these, I'm not a big medicine taker until now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to back this up.
Okay, so I'm rendering effectively an informal second opinion here.
I appreciate that.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much, doctor.
Thank you. Yeah, these are agents that do require a certain amount of finesse, and so it's important. I've always been taught it's important to give pretty specific instructions to patients and not just hand them three pieces of paper, so I hope that didn't happen to our caller. We also had a caller suggest some additional natural therapies for gout that they've found helpful. Looks like drinking lots of water. Yep, I'll agree with that. Extra B6 and vitamin C. Not sure, maybe those help get rid of the uric acid. Cherry juice and pineapple as anti-inflammatories. Okay, interesting recipe. I'm putting it out there, but not necessarily from a position of advocacy, since I haven't tried this in my own patients and have no experience. But somebody thinks it's good, and it certainly doesn't sound dangerous. Let's go to Deborah in Santa Cruz. Hello, Deborah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, I'll just start with a story. It is my husband, and he gets what appears like spontaneous bug bites, but they kind of welt up like a mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
become very itchy or just are immediately itchy, and then it turns into a small reddish bump. And they always appear under his clothes, not on exposed areas. Of note, he works in a hospital lab, and a number of his coworkers experience this. He knows this because it will happen while they're at work, and they'll, you know, comment, oh, you know, they got a bite, you know, it hurts, and then it's gone. And so they've talked about it at work. He never had it before he worked there. He's been to his PCP, two derms. They think it's bug bites. Been cultured twice for MRSA. It was negative. Mm-hmm. It may occur when he takes his clothes on or off, just a small amount of friction, maybe.
Okay, so how long do these last?
Well, they turn sort of into a small reddish. How long they last? I should ask him.
Hours, days, weeks?
Maybe a couple days.
Okay.
A little bump. Yeah,
little
then
bump.
Eventually goes away. The most itchy is initially, but they stay itchy. How long do they last? Days.
The thing about the coworkers is interesting.
Yes, it is.
And if he is not at work, does he ever get them?
Yes, he gets them at home.
And have you ever gotten one?
I have gotten them very infrequently, but I know what the feeling is because it just comes out of nowhere. And it's like, you know, something bit you, you look, there's nothing there. And then it sort of welts up.
Mm-hmm.
It even happens underwater when he takes a bath.
This is very, very intriguing. And each sentence that you come up with, I have this little hypothesis, and it's like I feel the air go out of that balloon, and then I come blow up another balloon, and then it's like, nope, there, boop, there goes that idea. Okay, bed bugs. Let me just do the download here. Bed bugs, possibly really odd, not this typical presentation. It's contagious, something jumping from person to person. Underclothes, again, that's sort of an insect-y kind of thing. It would be an interesting experiment. And this is going to ignore some of the data that you've given me because, like I said, I can't put it all together in a picture. So then you start trimming things and playing the what-if game. So what if you take something like a back scratcher and you scratch a big X on his back, fairly rough, not enough to draw blood, but basically hard enough, and then just stand back, come back and look at it in 5 minutes and see if he gets any of these wheels, these bumps that we're talking about in an X, in the pattern of the X.
In the pattern of the X.
Along the line of the X.
Okay.
It might be the whole X just lighting up beautifully, but that would be really positive. But if you get even a few of these where you just scratched, then what we're dealing with is a histamine reaction in the skin.
Okay.
And then you have to go figuring out why do you have a histamine reaction in the skin and how on earth is that happening in the lab? Are they inhaling something? Is there a reagent? You know, then you start getting really out there. But that would be an interesting test. That'd be the very first thing I did.
Okay.
If that did not show up, then I'd biopsy one of these bites and send it off to a dermatopathologist. And have them tell me what it looks like in there. Is it eosinophilic? Is it a neutrophilic? And, you know, there are certain patterns of induration, which is the lump that you're getting, that can help with making a distinction here. And then I'd biopsy two individuals, your husband and, you know, one of the coworkers or you, and see if you're all getting the same thing.
Yeah, it rarely happens.
I know, but I'm just kind of telling you how to approach it because I don't have a good idea.
Yeah, it's really strange, and no one else that comes to our home has developed it. You know, we have lots of guests, grandkids, all the time. And I did read in an RN magazine that I read about something just like this, but I tossed the magazine. I mean, this was, you know, like 3 years ago. It wasn't such a problem then. And
I'm not going to be able to.
I don't know what it was. You know, but it sounded so much like what is happening.
Yeah, but sound alike things don't necessarily prove much.
Okay.
You have to approach this kind of systematically at this point. Good luck.
Yeah. Okay, so no other suggestions. The big X and...
The big X, and then if that puts you on one path, and if that's a negative and you don't get lesions along the big X, then you're going to have to biopsy it and look at it under a microscope.
Okay, so if we do get something on the histamine reaction, then where does he go? To an allergist?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd do an elimination diet. And why don't you do it and call me back next week? Because I need to keep going now.
Okay. Thank you so much.
But we can pick it up next week if you've got that.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to our next caller, Lee in Santa Cruz. Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a 65-year-old male who works outside in construction. I'm very healthy. I get colds maybe every three or four years. I'm on day 19 of the roughest cold or the roughest illness I think I can remember in my life.
Oh, my goodness.
I have lost my voice for about 14 days. It's just now coming back. I went to the VA on about day 7, and I said, this is just more than an ordinary cold. I wasn't running a fever. It's always been in my head. It has never gone to my chest. Sleeping has been like trying to breathe underwater because of all of the postnasal drip and the coughing. So I cough for 15 minutes, sleep for 30, cough for 15. It's just been miserable. I'm now getting better. I can actually carry on conversations. But it's settled in my right ear, and I'm effectively deaf in my right ear. If I'm sleeping on my left side, I don't hear the alarm.
Right.
I don't hear my cell phone anymore.
Right.
I'm concerned. I mean, I'm like a week deaf in my right ear. I'm concerned for my hearing. I think I'm going to weather the cold all right eventually. A few of my friends have friends who've got this particular cold who say, yes, it is a hell of a cold and can last 3 weeks or more,
mm-hmm.
but I'm concerned for my hearing.
Well, I have some suggestions for how you can reassure yourself. Most likely, you've got an ear full of goo, the mucus that you were producing in your nose while you were sleeping, perhaps with that ear down, drifted up the eustachian tube, got into the middle ear, and has turned into rubber cement, and is just kind of sitting there, keeping the bones from moving.
Right.
So you've got effectively the same as if the bones were glued together. This is always a temporary state, but temporary can be qualified for several months. Extremely rare. Common things are common. That's the common one. Extremely rare thing that you probably do not have is what we call sudden sensory neural deafness, where people will get a virus and the virus involves the nerve in their ear and takes it down, and that's that. And the hearing's gone. That's very rare. I have seen it clinically, but it's rare. So
okay. If
you have that, there is nothing that conventional medicine can do for you. It's bad luck of the universe, but it's rare, and you probably have goo in your ear. So here's how you're going to find out. Go out and get some guaifenesin, G-U-A-I-F-E-N-E-S-I-N. Guaifenesin is what's in plain Robitussin, okay? It's in Mucinex, which is a trade name product. It's a expectorant, and you can find this very, very easily. It starts with G-U-A-I. There's nothing else on the shelf with that ingredient.
So
you take a fairly heavy dose of that, the maximum dose on the package, and you wait about an hour, and then you go into the bathroom, and you turn on the hot shower, and you run down the entire hot water heater. So you basically give yourself a steam bath, or you can do a bowl of boiling water and a towel and make a little tent, stay under it, and then when the steam dies, you do it again. And you do that for about 15 minutes.
Okay.
And while you're doing it, you're swallowing and yawning. And that twists and kind of kinks the eustachian tube. And if you're lucky, you'll get enough drainage from the middle ear that your hearing will improve. If it improves, it's goo. It's the common thing. And it's going to get better. Keep steaming. Keep taking the guaifenesin. And you will slowly get rid of the goo and your hearing will come back.
Okay.
Okay? So that's your mission, Mr. Phelps.
Wow.
Should you choose to accept it.
All right.
All right? And I sure hope that it's the goo.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm sorry you had such a terrible time with the cold. Sometimes allergies kick in this time of year on top of a cold. Do you have allergies?
None that I know of.
All right. Any itchy eyes?
No, but there were... mornings I would wake up, so much liquid was coming out of my eyes that my eyelids were cemented shut.
Okay. Yeah, virus from hell. You've just had a really nasty virus, and you will recover completely, except, you know, the hearing we can't be 100% sure of until that comes back.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thanks.
Don't worry so much. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Let's talk to Mardine in Ben Lomond. Hello, Mardine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here. I am calling because my son, who is 14 years old, on occasion, when he's just eating normally, will get food stuck in his, seems like it's down in his eustachian tube. It's after he swallows, and it you know, beyond the back of his throat, but then sort of gets stuck right behind his collarbone.
Mm-hmm.
And no amount of swallowing will make it move, and it hurts. It's painful. He'll have to come in and cough and try to, you know, cough it back up. Sometimes he has to throw up to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to be any particular kind of food. Mm-hmm. It does seem to be more thicker, heavier foods like, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwich or
right.
potatoes, you know, that kind of thing.
How old is your son?
14.
Okay. And how long has he had this problem?
It's been happening for about 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
At first it was every maybe 3 or 4 months. It would happen once and then not again. And we would think, okay, well, that was just, you know,
yeah.
something that happens. But it's getting more frequent lately. And I also recently mentioned it to his grandmother, his mm-hmm. paternal grandmother, and she said she had the same thing happen occasionally to her.
Well, I think everyone can have this happen once in a while, but the frequency that you're describing is a little concerning, and the fact that it's amplifying. I'm going to assume that you've done the following things, but we'll run through the checklist. First of all, one thinks of, does the person have a problem with their teeth such that they're not chewing well, and so they're attempting to swallow fragments of food that are just too large? The second thing I think of is, are they paying attention when they eat, or are they just like inhaling their food because, you know, they're on the internet and they're on their cell phone and they're, you know, triple tracking, and the actual chewing and swallowing piece is sort of getting lost. So you've looked at those two things and don't think that those are issues. Am I correct?
Yeah, we've talked about chewing, you know, carefully and taking smaller bites, especially when it has just happened like the day before. You know, he's very aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
We do tend to eat in front of the television a lot. You know, they're a little bit distracted, but he's a very slow eater. He takes twice as long to eat as we do. And so, you know, it's not that he's inhaling the food
okay.
without thinking
okay.
about it.
So the next thing that comes to mind is a physical narrowing of the esophagus. There is a condition where people will get achalasia, which is an inability to swallow or a painful swallow due to spasm of the esophagus. Maybe you've had a back spasm in your life. It just kind of grabs on you, and you can't move for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the esophagus, it's a round muscle, and so it'll grab down. And if it happens to grab on a piece of food, it's quite painful, and it's just stuck.
Mm.
So that's a possibility.
What causes that?
Good question.
Mm.
It's a spastic esophagus, and some people have it. You know, it's a neurological condition. It can be caused by damage to the nerve system. He's young enough that it could be congenital, and it just showed up when he got to a certain size. But the other thing could be some sort of physical narrowing. Now, there's something called an esophageal web, and again, sometimes these are congenital. So this could be a kind of an internal birth defect. The other thing is something growing in the area of the esophagus that's pushing back against it, and you're describing the collarbone. So the thyroid is right there. So I start thinking, I wonder if he's got a thyroid cyst, or I wonder if he's got a big lymph node back there. So the first step I would take medically in a situation like this would be to probably do a barium swallow, where a person swallows a radio-opaque fluid, and you get a little movie of their swallowing action. You get to see whether or not they are getting this esophageal grab phenomenon. You get to see whether the esophagus opens, stretches, and then closes down like a good elastic tube should as the swallows go down. And so a barium swallow and maybe a barium meal, which could be ordered together, barium studies of the esophagus, would be a good first step. And yes, this does involve some radiation exposure. It is more radiation than you would get from flying to New York City from a chest x-ray, for example, but it is not as much radiation as even a single CT scan. It's probably about a month worth of background radiation. I don't think that's a significant dose given the significance of his symptoms, because he is at risk for aspiration while he's trying to clear his throat, and if he makes himself have to vomit to get rid of this thing, if he sucks it down into a windpipe, he could be in serious trouble. So it's important to figure this out. If the barium swallow was normal, I would probably then do the ultrasound of the thyroid and make sure there's not a thyroid cyst or something behind the thyroid that's intermittently pushing on the esophagus. But I think the barium testing would be the most appropriate first step here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're uninsured and in a really bad financial situation right now, so it's difficult for us to get any kind of health care.
I am so sorry to hear that. You know, I would love to just get the fast-forward button on the time machine and get everybody covered, because this is just nuts. And under the plan that's just passed, a family like yours in financial difficulties would qualify for subsidies and probably would be able to have health insurance and take care of something like this rather than worrying about it.
Yeah, in 6 months or 4 years.
Yes, depending upon how your situation kicks out. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's a shame. Where I would go at this point is just avoid the foods that tend to be problematic and try not to induce vomiting. If it does get through, try to kind of erode it away by drinking liquids.
Yeah, we've
little
done
sips.
That.
Yeah, just little
sometimes
sips.
Sometimes helps. It sort of, sometimes it seems to get stuck more, you know.
Yeah, well, you can think of what you're doing. If there's a narrowing, you're basically ramming it past that narrowing.
Mm-hmm. At one point, he suggested that if I patted him on the back, that would feel good. That would, you know, it seemed like the right thing to do. And I did that kind of hard, you know, kind of pounding the middle of his back.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to dislodge it somewhat and
right.
Helped.
Makes sense. But, you know, given the things I've discussed, it would work for most of those. So it doesn't really narrow it down.
Yeah.
It does tell us that, yeah, it's acting like there's a physical blockage, but it could be a spasm.
Are there any pressure points or, like, breathing techniques that would relax spasmed muscle?
Let me think. You could try hitting some of the acupuncture points for the stomach. If you go online and look up acupuncture points, there's a point called Stomach 36.
Okay.
I'll put out the SOS to any acupuncturists out there who are listening. Do you have favorite points that you would suggest for this woman and her son? But acupressure at stomach 36, which is below the kneecap and to the outside of the leg. So easy to reach down and push on. Off the top of my head, not coming up with other points, but maybe we'll get some calls with suggestions before the end of the hour.
Okay.
All right. And I'll go do some research. And you listen to the show regularly?
Yes, I do.
All right. Listen next week and I'll see what I can come up with.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We had a couple of off-air comments about the lady who called about her son with the esophagus problem. And essentially what both callers said was that drinking hot water helps relax and expand the esophagus. So if it is a spasm, maybe drinking hot, obviously not steaming hot, but as hot as you can stand, water might help with the process. And that's an interesting idea and certainly one that's very, very testable. We've got time for a science lesson. What fun. Down syndrome, everyone probably knows, is due to having an extra chromosome 21. In fact, the other name for Down syndrome is trisomy 21. Now, we always thought traditionally that actually having an extra chromosome 21 meant that you would have too many proteins because you had an extra set of proteins and that led to the problem. But actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It appears that Down syndrome may largely be a problem of having not enough protein. Here's how it works. On chromosome 21, there are five segments that code for something called microRNA. And you make, if you have an extra chromosome 21, a lot of microRNA. MicroRNA is a gene inhibitor. MicroRNA prevents certain proteins from being expressed. We've known that messenger RNA is what travels from the nucleus to the ribosomes to make the protein. If you have a little piece of microRNA and you stick it like Velcro onto that messenger RNA, it inactivates it and prevents the protein from being made. And researchers studying this have found that both mice and humans with Down syndrome have a lot of extra microRNA in both their brains and in all of their body cells. Now, it turns out that one of these microRNAs is very fundamental in making a particular substance called methyl CpG binding protein 2. You don't need to know much about this MeCP2 except that this is what turns on protein production of two very important structural proteins in the brain. So if you've got too much micro RNA, you don't make enough of this promoter protein, which doesn't therefore get to the nucleus and turn on the production of two very important brain proteins. Neurologically speaking, this leads to mental retardation, and also it's extremely important in the development of the cardiovascular system, which probably is why people with Down syndrome have a lot of heart defects as well. So, what are we going to do with this? This represents something that might eventually turn into a drug therapy that could be given to children, infants with Down syndrome, and possibly reverse some or all of the defects that occur in their brain development. This could be really huge because it allows us to target the process in a way where you may stand a chance of fundamentally shifting what occurs. Stay tuned. I'll keep you posted, but this could be major. So we've got time for a couple more news stories. Let me tell you about stevia and atherosclerosis. Stevia is an artificial sweetener that has started to show up in both liquid and powdered forms. I personally like the liquid one a little bit better because I don't have to stir my tea for 5 minutes. The powdered one is not very soluble, doesn't dissolve easily enough for my tastes. But it is a naturally derived powdered leaf, basically, which does not have any of the downsides or potential downsides of the artificial sweeteners in the blue packets or the artificial sweeteners in the pink packets or the artificial sweeteners in the yellow packets. So good stuff. And it's in a green packet. So you can keep them separated by color coding, which I'm very happy about. The cool thing this article says is looking at mice. They have mice that have a tendency to develop diabetes, and they fed these 12-week-old mice for 12 weeks. So they started them out at 12 weeks of age. They fed them 10 milligrams per kilogram of stevia, and they had a placebo group, and they compared them on the same diet. And what they found was that while the rats had the same weight and triglyceride levels, the rats who got the stevicide had lower insulin, lower glucose, and a doubling in their adiponectin, which is a hormone that's released by body fat that lowers your appetite. They had improved antioxidant defense and therefore less inflammation. And extremely important, in their aortic arches, when they developed plaque, they had decreased macrophage activity and more stable plaque. So this indicates that the sort of instability of the plaque, where the bad cholesterol is loading in and the inflammatory system is active, this instability is what we associate with heart attacks and strokes, is reduced. And they found increased superoxide dismutase in the plaque, which means a more stable plaque, a plaque that's less likely to erupt and turn into a heart attack. All of this being done by stevicide. Now, the real question about this study is dosing, because unfortunately, at 10 milligrams per kilogram, we're talking about the average person needing 700 or 800 milligrams a day if the dosing is linear. That isn't necessarily the case, though, and it may be a nonlinear dosing effect. If so, it could be that even the amounts that a person sweetening their beverages with stevia would consume in a typical day could have a significant positive effect on heart disease for them. So that's something I'm really very excited and am looking forward to learning more about. So good news there. Just a quick little announcement as we come to the end of the show. With all of the news on healthcare, a few things have escaped the notice of the front pages of the newspapers, but there is currently an issue with one of the two rotavirus vaccines. All of the doctor's offices have been informed of this, but I want to encourage people not to avoid getting their children vaccinated for rotavirus. The problem that we're having with the one vaccine, which is the Rota-Rix vaccine, is that a virus that shouldn't be there was found in the vaccine. This is not a virus that causes disease in humans. Okay, so it's not that the Rota-Rix vaccine is dangerous, and it's not, if your child got it last month or 6 months ago, it's not that there is a problem with the vaccine. The issue with the vaccine is that a harmless virus was found in it, and that means that they need to retool and pull that vaccine, because even a harmless virus that we don't intend to be in a vaccine doesn't belong there. But there is no evidence that this is dangerous. There's no reason for concern. And before anybody gets panicky, I just wanted to put that out there. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.